What's Coming for Developers with Amanda Silver.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host, for helping you and your teams move fast and deliver quality and run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. And I and others are continuing to do tons of online user group speaking. And so if you run a .NET or Azure-related user group, please get in touch. This episode is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. So if they can help, please get in touch. And also make sure to check out the new video show, Architect Tips. I think there's 7 or 8 episodes out at this point. And I'm excited for today's guest. We have Amanda Silver on the show, and she is the Corporate Vice President of Product for Microsoft's Developer Division, which includes Visual Studio, the whole family of products, .NET, TypeScript, and the Azure Developer Platform, like App Service, the Platform as a Service items. And she's been a key player to Microsoft's transformation to contribute to open source with the introduction of TypeScript, Visual Studio Code, and the acquisition of both Xamarin and GitHub. And she believes that a tight digital feedback loop with zero distance between end users and engineering teams is a critical element of great product development. Amanda, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks, Jeff Lee. I'm great. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm excited to have you on the show. You've been a mover and a shaker there at Microsoft, and you've done so many things over the years. But for people who might not be as familiar with you or heard your other speaking, I always like to ask the guest, what's been your journey like? What have been some of the key things at Microsoft that have kind of led you into what you're doing today?
Oh, great question. Well, I mean, I started at Microsoft in 2001, and so that was really right after the first release of .NET. And as soon as I started, we were starting to work on what we internally called Everett, which was the 1.1 release. And my first job at Microsoft was working on pinvokes, .NET interop with native libraries. And that kind of started me getting focused on programming language design. And for the first 8 or so years of my journey at Microsoft, I was doing Visual Basic .NET. And, you know, during that period, that's when we introduced generics and we did Link and integrated XML in Visual Basic .NET. And, you know, had many, many debates about where's C# going, where's Visual Basic going, and kind of, I'm sure you remember that tension in that era. And then I started getting into, I've always been somebody who, you know, I think we should have as many people in the industry as we possibly can. And I really want to make sure that you know, it's really easy for people to create with technology. And so I thought the next best thing to focus on was office automation, because mm-hmm. a lot of people do, you know, VBA development to automate their Excel scripts and things like their Excel spreadsheets and things like that. So I did that for a couple of years and worked on kind of the precursor to what is today the Office extensibility model, which continues to evolve and we continue to work on it. And then after that, I got into JavaScript. I took a kind of sharp left turn and I started working on the Chakra JavaScript engine, which was the JavaScript engine behind Internet Explorer up until, we took the Chromium code base and incorporated it into Microsoft Edge. And so I did that for a couple of years. And it was during that time that we introduced TypeScript. So I was working on TypeScript for a while, and then I started working on Windows tools and then the Visual Studio core platform. And from there, it just kind of snowballed. And, and, uh, And, you know, now I work on pretty much everything developer at Microsoft.
Nice, nice. And, you know, you have a blog online that we'll include the link to the show notes, and you continue to write. And you're at almost every Microsoft conference, kind of showcasing some of the big things that are coming out. Before we kind of dive in, how is your team organized? You're the CVP of product, but how does that play out? Well, different from product and program managers, and then of course you have tons of engineers that are writing tons of code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I have an incredible partnership with my engineering counterparts who run the core engineering teams of each one of the different kind of sections of the developer division. And my team basically has the PM discipline, the design discipline, and the user research discipline. And when it comes to product development, we are very much of an integrated team in that each one of the disciplines contributes on a daily basis with each of the engineering teams. Some user research teams really execute kind of on their own, almost like a dispatch, like, hey, I need you to go research this big question that we have. They go off for 3-4 months and come back with a paper that is supposed to kind of inform you, and then you make a decision based upon it. With my user research team and the way that we do product development in the developer division, it's hand in hand with the user research team every single day, because my philosophy and kind of the way that we run our teams is that we need to talk to our customers, the people we aspire to be our customers, every single day. And that's the only way that we can make sure that we're building products that people love and use. And so I really think it's important that that we facilitate that user research with everybody in the team, including the engineering team. And so, we have a kind of practice inside of the developer division where we will have, regular interviews with our users. We would use the language that we're testing a hypothesis, that we have, we believe that this customer, this user has a particular problem. We think this solution that we've come up with would address that problem, but we don't take it at face value based on how much we trust the PM or the engineer who came up with that idea. We actually do validation with customers every step of the way to make sure that we're, I think of it as de-risking the product, that we're basically actually testing with our actual, customers that we would like to use this product or use this feature to make sure that it's solving their pain points, that it's actually something that's important to them, and that they, I think the thing that is really important in terms of software, especially when you're thinking about either introducing a new feature that people might not be using, or especially when you're trying to get someone to stop using the product that they're using today and to switch over to use your product, any kind of workflow interruption, anything that is disrupting kind of the inertia that you have in your regular day-to-day process, especially when muscle memory is involved, that's a really high cost. And so I have a high bar that I need to see that the investments that we're making in our software is actually going to make a difference to our users, and it's going to have the impact that we want it to have.
I see what you're saying. There's some muscle memory I have from 2003 when I first started using ReSharper, where some of those shortcut keys, as many things as Visual Studio has added hotkeys and ReSharper, there's some that's like, oh, what's the one for this? And yeah, it's baked in.
Yeah. And I would say, on that, we've documented all of our hotkeys, it's all configurable. So, I think that's a good opportunity for you to customize your hotkeys.
Right. Now, you have a particular worldview on how the process of development should be and how developers can be more effective. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think one of the things that we're seeing and that we've seen over the last few years is, first of all, that there's a huge shortage of developers in the world, in relationship to the demand of digital solutions that everybody wants to create. And so, what does that mean? You know, what that means is that every developer needs to be more productive, more effective in terms of, you know, what they're able to create alone and as a team. It means that we need, as developers, we need to collaborate with other disciplines to create these digital solutions. And I also think that we need to bring a lot more people into the workforce that are capable of creating with technology. And so, so to me, that kind of dimension brings up all of these questions around how do we collaborate as developers? How do we mentor? How do we bring on, you know, junior people into the industry and kind of into our teams? How can we make the code bases that we're building more learnable so that people can be self-guided and learn as they go? How can we make sure that our engineering systems are more resilient so that, you know, if somebody does check in something that's bad code, that we can find that out as early as we possibly can? And ideally, how do we prevent them from checking in that bad code from in the first place, right? And so it's all those kinds of things that I'm thinking about, along with the fact that, you know, the developer industry and people who are developers today are much more geographically distributed than they've ever been before. Obviously, with the pandemic, we're all, a lot of us working from home for the first time, very, you know, geographically distributed. But even before that, we already were moving towards geographically distributed workforces. And, you know, the classic developer problem is, it worked on my machine, and even worse, it's like it reproed on my machine. Like I have a bug, and it only fails on my machine, and I don't know why. If you're in some remote location in your home office, you know, who are you going to call to go help you work through this issue?
Yeah.
And then do you do screen sharing, or like how does that all work, right? And so that's a category of kind of the types of problems that we've been really trying to work through.
You mentioned that we need so many more developers. What's your thoughts on the education required to get in? You know, for on one end, to be a certain type of surgeon, you need so many extra years of education after, you know, what you typically call university. And you know, there's plenty of bachelors of computer science, but then there's all these coding boot camps that are popping up. And then some people are just starting in high school and then never even going to school because it's just 100% self-teach. Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a force, I want to see where you see it, that demands so many more developers that we're just going to have to figure out how to not make them wait or spend so many years of education before start being productive.
And we are. I mean, I think we're already seeing a lot of people without formal education in computer science come into the industry, or maybe they had a degree in a different discipline and made a career change. We're seeing a lot of people come in through boot camps. I think we're also seeing the tools respond, right? When we think about things like low-code tools, and really, like Visual Basic was one of the first, you know, classic kind of low code tools that was a drag and drop experience for a lot of people. And then you had to write a little bit of code. But, you know, that the fact is that our tools are getting a heck of a lot better to make it possible for people to create data bound, you know, applications that basically can work for a certain category of apps. And so the way that I think about it is, you know, not every developer is skilled for every developer job, right? We have some people who are writing operating systems and systems level, you know, multiprocessor, you know, dealing with like they're writing the garbage collector, they're writing, you know, all of these low level systems. And that just requires a level of sophistication that is extraordinarily advanced, right? Any time that I get into a category of like, oh, you need to do memory profiling, that's a pretty sophisticated you know, task as a developer. And you know, of course, are we going to end up with a lot more slow software because we don't have people who are capable of doing memory profiling? Yes, that is true. But at the same time, we need to build better tools to actually make it easier for people to diagnose memory problems in their applications. But like, if you think about line of business applications and a lot of what people need to do just to automate business processes, I don't think that it requires the same level of sophistication as what, you know, somebody who can do memory profiling analysis on. And so I do think that it's possible for people to, you know, come in with a non-traditional background and self-teach and kind of work their way up and gather the skills on the job. And yeah, I mean, I think as professional developers that might facilitate that, we need to think about how do we put the checks and guards in place to make sure that those people who are creating with low-code tools are not creating something that becomes a liability for your organization or becomes a servicing nightmare or support nightmare. But, you know, that's one of the major things that I've been working on with the Power Platform team over the last couple of years is making sure that we can actually use a common engineering system for applications that are created with the Power Platform.
Nice. Well, and just jumping off of the talk about tools, we have a new Visual Studio that's going to be coming out, what, later this year or next year?
Yeah, later this year. We just released the first preview of it and are almost very close to releasing the second preview of it. And yeah, it's going to be the first version of Visual Studio that is 64-bit native. And so, you know, especially for folks who have very, very large solutions, you know, hundreds of projects that they're working on simultaneously, or that they need to load to be able to work on the one portion of their application that they're working on, you know, that will address a lot of out-of-memory issues that people have been seeing. And so I expect that some people are going to end up seeing kind of an outsized impact of the fact that this is now 64-bit. But I think most people, you know, might not notice that it's 64-bit. It'll just work, and our ecosystem is going to continue to work. But the other stuff that's coming is also super exciting. You know, one of the things that we did is we introduced whole line completion in the code editor so that we can basically use our machine learning models that do predictive analysis on the code that you're going to write based on the code that you've already written to complete the rest of the line of code that you need to write next. And so I think, you know, things like that, the repeated edits, the intelligent suggestions that we have now that are based on the edits that you've already committed in the project, AI is going to kind of become more central to the way that your code editor actually works. And then also like with .NET 6 and everything that's coming there, hot reload is a huge feature for .NET 6, and that shows up in the next version of Visual Studio. And I think that is going to kind of be a sea change in terms of the productivity of a .NET developer, because it means their iteration cycles can be a lot faster. It's kind of like when, you know, editing continue was first introduced to .NET. It made a huge difference. I think this is that same level of impact.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
Now, you mentioned machine learning and AI. How does that work? How does that manifest itself? When people think artificial intelligence, aside from the experts who are working in it, it's kind of this word. It's like, okay, what does that mean?
I think the best way to think about it is that it basically can predict and anticipate your next move and make some suggestions as you're going along. And so, you know, when we think about the how it can help developers, we think about it in three different categories. There's the text-to-text translation, which is not related to code per se. So this would be like natural language to natural language. So for example, you could imagine, could I take, you know, English, translate it to Spanish? Could I'm writing a paper and I need to have a way to describe a concept, or I'm writing some copy for a website. It can actually generate, you know, somewhat, you know, realistic looking, English text for that copy for that website. But in the coding world, we think about it in the three categories, which are not text to text. We think about it as code to text, which is like, how can I take code that you've written and essentially self-document it? I can convert, I can basically like, you know, describe based on the code that you've written, documentation on the API that you wrote. Code to code, which might be something like translating from one programming language into another programming language, or as in the example of the whole line completion that I was just talking about, looking at the code that you've already written to predict and anticipate what is the next set of code that you're going to be writing. And then the last is text to code, where we could take something like a comment or maybe the method name that you've used or the class name that you've used in the code that you've written thus far, because that's not, you know, structured code, it's a literal that you've described, you've chosen a name for, that essentially is natural language. And so we can take that and input that into, essentially it's a matrix of incredibly sophisticated algorithms to create that matrix. But ultimately, it's a matrix that describes the probability of what is the next, line of code that you're going to write, or how to interpret, the natural language that you wrote for the code comment and translate that into code.
That's interesting. It's like the other side of the coin from static code analysis of, hey, you might want to think about this code you've already written. Are you sure about that?
It is. And I think that actually has been one of the most interesting aspects of this whole journey is the user experience and how do we think about surfacing the user experience? Because, you know, again, like I always think in terms of the tools and kind of how do we create the tools and developer tools traditionally, historically, have always been static analysis. And so the expectation that a developer has is that everything is discrete, meaning that it's almost like binary, but basically it's like, it's one or the other. It's a yes or no answer. There's no nuance. It's not like, you know, you either have a compiler error, maybe this is kind of a compiler error.
Right.
Like, no, that doesn't exist. Right. Or something like in a linter, like that's one of the things that's frustrating about linters is sometimes it identifies false positives and it does that because it is doing static analysis. And sometimes you need to suppress warnings from linters, right? But with probabilistic analysis, where it's actually looking at inputs and it's coming up with a probabilistic suggestion or analysis that you have a bug or something like that, it really changes the developer expectations of what they're getting from the tool. And so we needed to figure out how we can signal that to our users so that they can understand that this is a little bit different than a static analysis warning. And that this is this is something that's based on our calculations, but it's not necessarily 100% right. And in fact, I was kind of, this is a little bit maybe, I don't know, I kind of feel a little bit mixed about this analogy, but in some ways I think that it is apt, is, when you chat with a doctor about a prognosis for something that, a disease that you have, they are not able to give you discrete results. They can only give you probabilistic results. They can say, based on, you know, the experience, based on people with your history and the condition that you're presenting, you know, you have this kind of likely outcome, right?
Right.
And in some ways, what we found with this is that we need to have more like a bedside manner in terms of how we present these results. Because if we present it as you have a security bug, then we sometimes find that actually affects the trust of the system from the user. That they, you know, if there's any possibility that this is a false positive, then it destroys that trust, right? But if we instead say, hey, there's something here that you know, doesn't meet these security best practices, then a developer is going to take a second look and they're going to say, oh, like, I definitely want to go take a, you know, a strong look at what the machine has identified for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's some things where a doctor can say, yep, your femur is broken. And then, but with viruses, or it's like, well, this looks like this other thing.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Awesome. Well, yeah. with all the new advances in the coding experiences, I would expect they'd be in the full Visual Studio, but what about Visual Studio Code? What's the vision for that? It's like this parallel editor, but does it get everything that Visual Studio is going to get eventually and is catching up, or what's the path or the vision for that product?
I mean, you know, we did Visual Studio Code in part because, you know, when we were thinking about what we wanted Azure to be, we want it to be a cloud for all developers. And, you know, Visual Studio traditionally is primarily C# and C++ developers that are the most predominant users of Visual Studio. So when it comes to Python, JavaScript, you know, Rust, Go, PHP, you know, all of these other programming languages that Visual Studio doesn't really serve as well. That's where, when we did the analysis to figure out what do those developers want and use, they want a lightweight code editor. That's what they use today. That's what they had been using prior to Visual Studio Code. And then it was a question of like, well, what is the point of view? Like, we can't just create, you know, we're not going to create Emacs. We wouldn't be able to, you know, it kind of comes back to what we talked about earlier in the show, to disrupt my workflow and to disrupt my muscle memory. I need to have something that's compelling enough that solves a problem for me that I'm going to make a switch, that I'm going to make an investment as a human into learning this new technology and incorporating it into my daily life. And so for us, for Visual Studio Code, the angle was a small amount of debugging. So it's a lightweight code editor with a small amount of debugging. And that continues to be the vision for Visual Studio Code. I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to things like collaborating with others via Visual Studio Live Share or IntelliCode and Copilot and kind of AI assistance in your code editor, those kinds of things will come to Visual Studio Code. We have extensions for basically every Azure service, every, you know, and AWS and GCP for that matter. You know, it's not designed to be an IDE, which I would think of as like a cockpit for your code editing experience, right? I almost think about an IDE as an operating system for development, right? It not only has your code editor in it, it is the inclusive environment that has everything that you actually need. Plus, it has specific apps, you know, for designers or for, you know, memory profiling or other things like that, that are much more sophisticated for the domain that you're working on, right? And so I think that's kind of the difference in vision for Visual Studio Code and Visual Studio. We don't intend to turn Visual Studio Code into a full-fledged IDE, into an operating system for developers. We want it to stay as a lightweight code editor. We want it to be the best lightweight code editor in the world. But it is distinct from Visual Studio in that fashion.
That's a great distinction to make. A full-fledged integrated development environment versus a really awesome text editor.
Yeah, exactly.
And now you probably have the real numbers, but I've heard that Visual Studio Code is either very close to or has already become the most popular coding text editor out there. Is there any truth to that from data you see?
There's truth to that, and can't think of any particular example off the top of my head. But basically, if you look at, you know, the Python community, the JavaScript community, you know, a lot of them do surveys every year, and you know, we've been fortunate enough to kind of make it into the top one or two for pretty much every major programming language across the board with Visual Studio Code.
Nice.
So yeah, I think Visual Studio Code is definitely a very, 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 very popular lightweight code.
It's definitely compelling. It made a lot of people switch.
Yeah,
so that's great.
Exactly.
And this, there's a lot of Visual Studio Code in GitHub Code Spaces, isn't there? How do those products fit together?
Great question. So GitHub Code Spaces, you know, the way that you can think about it is that it's basically like an instant developer environment in the cloud. And so when you think about what it takes to actually set up a dev box, you have to install the SDKs, you have to install the tools, and you obviously need to have compute and storage on your local machine to be able to host your developer environment. What we've done with CodeSpaces is we've basically built a compute environment that is instant on, so that we can quickly install the SDKs, have that pre-installed via containerization and things like that. And we have the tools designed in such a way that they can just kind of hook into that environment almost like a remote debugging session. So that you have an instant on compute environment hosted in the cloud. And so what that means is that you might get the front end experience of Visual Studio Code, and it's based on the same code base, but it's connecting to this compute environment that we've created to host the you know, execution and kind of the way that your developer environment runs.
It's like a developer workstation in the cloud that you just a URL launched development.
Exactly.
Computer.
And I think what's so awesome about it, obviously, like DevBox setup is a huge pain point for a lot of developers.
Oh, yeah.
And this, you know, takes it down from sometimes it's over a half a day or a whole day, if you know, especially if you're running Python, down to a couple of seconds. And so that's just a huge time saver. And when you think about, you know, how often you have to set up a new developer environment, like for, you know, information workers or people who are not, you know, developers, a lot of them don't have to set up another environment ever. Like they get a new computer and
it's got
they
Microsoft
install
Office,
the software
I'm good.
That they need and like, we're done.
Yeah.
But for developers, we have to do it every time we're learning a new domain. We have to do it every time we have to go investigate a bug that's, you know, in our code base that's a few months old or whatever it is. Every time we're doing a boot camp or we have to onboard a new developer onto our team, we're constantly setting up new developer environments. And so this, I think, will make a huge impact in terms of you know, the ability for people to be more productive individually. But also, I think it really helps with onboarding new developers onto the team, because these environments are consistent, right? It's not like you have a different environment variable and path, you know, because you installed the SDKs in a different order, which can often happen. And for you know, two developers sitting side by side in the same office with two different machines, the fact that this is a repeatable environment actually makes it more consistent, so that, you know, you can have fewer, you know, developer environment issues come up for your developer team. And so it just takes away a lot of the headaches that a junior developer might have to deal with.
Absolutely. For our local scouting troops, I'm a computer programmer merit badge counselor, and I would love to be able to equip the kids with that just for teaching so that they wouldn't have to set it up.
Exactly.
When is it going to be widely available?
It will be very, very soon. So we are very, very, very soon. So we're I'm not going to say any specific date yet, but it'll be later this summer.
Okay. Summer, not fall. Sweet. Okay. I was going to ask the end of the year, but before that, that'd be great. Awesome. Well, we've talked about so much today. Is there anything that the listeners just need to hear before we wrap up?
Oof. Wow. We did cover a lot of ground.
And they can look forward to some GitHub code spaces later this summer, some Visual Studio 2022 by the end of the year, and a lot going on with Azure PaaS as well.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that is one thing that we didn't get to talk about.
The price is just cut in half recently, right? With the V3 instances.
Yeah, there's all different. I mean, it's hard to kind of speak about any Azure PaaS service pricing kind of uniformly because each service has its own pricing. But I think one of the biggest pieces of work that we're working on right now is the fact that we're taking a lot of the Azure PaaS services, whether that's app service or functions or even APIM, and we are making it so that they all run on top of Kubernetes, which makes it easier to have a consistent control plane for all of these different app services. So you can have kind of consistent operations and management without having to change the developer environment. The developer still gets the productive experience that they've come to know and love and have used for many years. But now they don't need to change anything to allow their operator to be able to host it in Kubernetes and manage it in Kubernetes.
So let me make sure I'm hearing this right. Just from the most simple vanilla, I'm throwing a website up with app service. Under the covers, it's going to be running on top of Kubernetes, and I don't have to do anything.
Correct.
Sweet. So when I graduate to maybe package something up as a container, I still continue to stick that container in app service.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a little bit different because, you know, not everything has been containerized. That's kind of a different category, but basically the service itself can run on top of Kubernetes.
I love the vision that because there's been this parallel thing of, oh, Azure PaaS, you doing it for Azure or are you containerizing all of your stuff? And I was just thinking, man, it's like this big divide. You have to pick one or the other and it changes so many things. But now it's like, well,
yeah.
Everybody's talking about containers being the future. Okay, it's kind of obvious, but how soon of a future and how is that going to manifest?
Yeah, and I think the big thing is like Kubernetes is so much in the zeitgeist and the terminology of everybody, what everybody's thinking about, that a lot of developers are like, I have to go learn Kubernetes.
Yes.
And once you do that, it's a beast. That is a beast in a kind of rabbit hole that you would need to go down. And I think what we're basically saying is like, no, you actually don't. Like, you know, you can continue to use Azure PaaS and basically higher level app hosting services without having to learn Kubernetes, but still be able to get the benefits from Kubernetes in terms of, you know, being able to run your apps anywhere and have consistent management experiences.
Nice, nice. Now, just vision-wise, do you think that'll translate to a developer workstation environment? Like right now, we can't run app service locally on our own individual computer. You know, we can't just take all that and say, oh yeah, I'm just doing it locally. Does that maybe give a platform to slide in and be able to have an actual similar environment locally?
Well, I mean, all of this kind of, you know, will run using Azure Arc as the management plane. And so Azure Arc is designed to be hybrid. So that means that it can run in Azure, it can run in your hardware.
Ooh, very nice. Very nice. Awesome. Well, we have covered a lot. So thank you so much for coming on the show. We'll include links to all this in the show notes. And you have very busy days and working on just tons of products, but we appreciate it. It makes every developer's life better.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.